The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled How to Prepare for the Afterlife, is dedicated to the memory and Le'ilui Nishmos Shimon ben Moshe Tzvi and Shabtai ben Moshe Aleichem Shalom, Mr. Simon Lefkowitz and Mr. Robert Yehia of blessed memory.
What really happens to us when we die? Does our personality and consciousness come to a complete and irrevocable end with only our decaying bodies, a tombstone, and perhaps flowery eulogies and obituaries as the only trace remaining of our lives? Or does our consciousness or soul survive the destruction of our body and move to a different plane, or perhaps remain on this earth? This is a question I'm sure has crossed your mind more than once. Whenever a close relative or friend dies or becomes seriously ill, God forbid, we're reminded of our own mortality and vulnerability, and we're often forced to face the difficult question we normally push back to the recesses of our mind. What is going to happen to us when we die? Up until about a century and a half ago, our ancestors would have answered this question without a doubt. Our consciousness or spirit leaves our body after death to be judged and placed in a spiritual domain appropriate for the spiritual level that we have attained on this earth. That would be their answer. Many of us today, however, would be uncomfortable with that answer. To a large degree, this is due to a single book that took the world by storm 140 years ago and changed the way modern man looks at the world and at his own consciousness. The name of that book is The Origin of the Species by Charles Darwin. The thesis of that book, that man is essentially an animal who is descended from lower species, enabled many serious thinkers to view their consciousness as merely the workings of the chemical and electrical processes of the brain. Hence, when the brain dies, the personality and consciousness comes to an end. Besides being a far-reaching theory that explained the various life forms presently on this planet and the extinct life forms in the fossil record, it had a tremendous emotional appeal. Think about it. If we're truly animals and there's no judgment or afterlife, we really have complete and absolute freedom. We're free from guilt because since there are no laws and no judgment, we have essentially done nothing wrong. And we are free from the constraints of organized religion. No priest or rabbi is going to control our lives. The secular view soon became the mainstream educated view of life. And as we'll see, its followers clung to its tenets and dogmas as tenaciously as the religious establishment that they displaced. Amongst Jews, this secular view has become extremely pervasive. In a 1952 Gallup poll, when asked if they believe in life after death, over 3 out of 4 Americans responded that they definitely believed in life after death. Only 1 out of 3 Jews said that they shared that belief. By 1965, 3 out of every 4 Americans still responded that they definitely believed in life after death. However, by that time, less than 1 out of every 5 Jews said that they shared that belief. This attitude has had far-reaching results. Jews no longer comfortable with the notions of soul, judgment, afterlife, and commandments saw different means of expressing their desire to find meaning in life. Many turned to secular religions, communism, socialism, secular Zionism. Others felt uncomfortable and totally abandoning their religious traditions, were just as uncomfortable in totally embracing them. After all, if we were basically advanced animals without hope of an afterlife, all the traditional religious laws and rituals no longer make much sense. So we created new forms of expression or modified the old to conform to our new worldview and our psychological needs. As a result, many Jews found a happy compromise between their feelings of Jewishness and their secular worldview. But things are never static. Today, the secular religions of communism, socialism, and secular Zionism have by and large lost their appeal. And the attempt to combine Jewish tradition with a secular worldview, which made sense to generations who remember with pride and love how their Zaidi and Bobby, their grandparents, clung to tradition, no longer has the same success. Witness the ever-increasing rate of intermarriage and assimilation amongst Jews. And in the midst of all of this, oddly enough, the very basis of the secular materialistic view of life has been now seriously challenged by a new generation of researchers who've compiled very impressive evidence that there actually is life after death. Tonight, we are going to conduct a search for scientific evidence of life after death, a search of what Jewish sources say about the afterlife and how to prepare yourself for it, and a search for the ultimate meaning in life. We have divided this lecture into 10 sections, the first letter of each section spelling out the acronym SEARCH and LIFE. First, the S of SEARCH is soul. What is the soul? The Torah, in describing the creation of the first man, and we'll read this together. This is on top of page 2. Hashem Elohim, and the Lord God, formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living soul. The term breath of life is nishmas chayim. It's neshama. The word neshama, which means a soul, really comes from breath. And in the sense that figuratively, God breathed of himself into us. Actually, according to the Kabbalah, according to the mystic tradition, there are three basic elements of the soul. There is the ruach, the spirit, and we have in paragraph B, referring to the afterlife. And the dust returns to the earth. This is from Koheles, Ecclesiastes, in chapter 12, verse 7. The dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit, v'haruach, returns unto God who gave it. The spirit, the ruach, is what we are. That's our consciousness. That's our personality. There's a lower form of spirituality, which we have in paragraph C, which is our nefesh. And referring to spilling blood, the term, and again, you can look in paragraph C in the first section. And surely regarding the spilling of your blood, which forms your life force, your nefesh, will I require that justice be meted out. For murder or for suicide, there will ultimately be a judgment. The term there is nefesh. Nefesh is the life source. Nefesh is what make your soul, your cells operate. It's the sense of life which is infused in this world. It's not necessarily conscious, but it's there. So we have our nefesh, which is the life source. This is the energy, so to speak, that runs through us. There's our consciousness. This is the ruach, our spirit. And then there's the neshama, which is the breath of God in us. It's our connection to God. It's as if, in a certain sense, if you look at your consciousness, your ruach, that you are pulled in two directions. One is towards God, and that's through your neshama. That's what the neshama is your connection to God. And everyone has a different sherish on neshama, a different place, a different root, a different area where you're connected to God. And the other is your nefesh, is your earthiness, is your feeling of life and zest. Freud would call that the id. But that's your feeling of life. So there's your body, the life of your body, which is nefesh. There's ruach, which is your spirit. And then there's neshama. The mystics explain that our goal in life, the years that we're here, is to make a metamorphosis, is to change our ruach, our spirit, and to make it more like the neshama, like the soul, like God, than the nefesh, than just the life source of our body. We are supposed to change, to make this metamorphosis in our ruach, in our consciousness. It's this ruach, besides the neshama, which survives bodily death. You know, many have asked the question, about the question of life after death, but nobody's come back to tell us. But the truth is, there are many people who have come back. In 1975, a small book was published by a small publishing house, Mockingbird's books, that became overnight an international bestseller. It was written by a doctor, Dr. Raymond Moody, and it was called Life After Life. And essentially, there were interviews of people who claimed that they had died. Their consciousness left their body, and they lived to tell the story because they were resuscitated. The stories that were told were remarkably similar, but not the same. The full-blown, if one would take all the parts of this puzzle and reconstruct the total story, and I'm quoting Dr. Moody, it would read like this. A man is dying, and as he reaches the point of greatest physical distress, he hears himself pronounced dead by his doctor. He begins to hear an uncomfortable noise, a loud ringing or buzzing, at the same time feels himself moving very rapidly through a long, dark tunnel. After this, he suddenly feels himself outside his own physical body, but still in the immediate physical environment, and he sees his own body from a distance, as though he was a spectator. He watches the resuscitation attempt from this unusual vantage point and is in a state of emotional upheaval. After a while, he collects himself, becomes much more accustomed to his odd condition. He notices that he still has a quote-unquote body, but one of a very different nature and with very different powers from the physical body that he has left behind. Soon other things begin to happen. Others come to meet and to help him. He glimpses the spirit of relatives and friends who have already died, and a loving, warm spirit of a kind he has never encountered before, a being of light, appears before him. This being asks him a question, non-verbally, to make him evaluate his life, and helps him along by showing him a panoramic, instantaneous playback of the major events of his life. At some point, he finds himself approaching some sort of barrier or border, apparently representing the limit between earthly life and the next life. Yet he finds that he must come back to earth, that the time for his death has not yet come. At this point, he resists, for by now he is taken up with his experiences in the afterlife and does not want to return. He is overwhelmed by intense feelings of joy, love, and peace. Despite his attitude, though, he somehow reunites with his physical body and lives. Later he tries to tell others, but he has trouble doing so. In the first place, he could find no human words adequate to describe these unearthly episodes. He also finds that others scoff, so he stops telling other people. Still, the experience affects his life profoundly, especially his views about death and its relationship to life. This is a composite report, of course. No one, as Dr. Moody reported, has all the elements, even though many have most of the elements. In this overview of this afterlife experience, Dr. Moody describes this spiritual body. The Kabbalists describe a spiritual body. In fact, they maintain that we know that there are 248 positive commandments. There are 365 negative commandments. According to the Mekubalim, according to the Jewish mystics, every commandment has some sort of correspondence in this spiritual body. I'd like to describe in greater detail the spiritual body from the people who claim they had this near-death experience. This is the first account. When I came out of the physical body, it was like I did come out of my body and go into something else. I didn't think I was just nothing. It was another body. And as this person is outside of his body, he's looking at his body that's comatose, but he's now in a different body. But it was not another regular human body. It was a little bit different. It was not exactly like a human body, but it wasn't any big glob of matter either. It had form to it, but no colors. And I know I still had something you could call hands. I can't describe it. I was more fascinated with everything around me, seeing my body there and all. So I didn't think about the type of body I was in. And all this seemed to go so quickly. Time wasn't really an element. And yet it was. Things seem to go faster after you get out of your body. The second account is, I remember being wheeled into the operating room and the next few hours were the critical period. During that time, I kept getting in and out of my physical body and I could see it from directly above. But while I did, I was still in a body, not a physical body, but something I could best describe as an energy pattern. If I had to put it into words, I would say that it was transparent, a spiritual as opposed to a material being, yet it definitely had different parts. One of the very interesting things about the near-death experience is the fact that many people claim, again, they left their body, but yet describe in great detail the events of what occurred in the room when they were supposedly totally out. One of the researchers, a cardiologist, by the name of Dr. Michael Sabon, in a book that he wrote in the early 1980s called Recollections of Death, cited of some 100 cases that he interviewed. He was the cardiologist. There were 25 cases, people who had a clear recollection of the exact resuscitation machinery and how they were resuscitated. He compared this with a control group of people who made no such claims, but perhaps picked up knowledge through TV shows and other. Those who did not make these claims had almost no knowledge of resuscitation. And yet those who did had a very clear knowledge of it and the machinery. He was very impressed. But let me read to you another account. This is from another cardiologist, Dr. Maurice Rawlings, in a book that he wrote, Beyond Death's Door. And he describes a patient who came with heart problems but evidently suffered from suicidal tendencies. And I'm going to read this account quickly. One such patient was a nurse. At the hospital one day, I was asked to see her in consultation about her heart because of complaints and recurrent chest pains. She was not in her room, but her roommate said she was either in the x-ray department or still in the bathroom. I knocked on the bathroom door. Hearing no response, I swung the door open very slowly, hoping not to embarrass anyone who might be there. As the door swung open, there was a nurse hanging from the coat hook on the back of the bathroom door. She was not very large, and so she swung easily with the opening door suspended from the coat hook by a soft collar used for neck sprains. Apparently, she had attached this collar around her neck, then fastened the edge of it over the hook, gradually bending her knees until unconsciousness occurred. No suffocation or choking, just a gradual fainting. The more that faintness occurred, the more she slumped. At death, her face, tongue, and eyes were bulging and swollen. Her face had a dark bluish tinge. The rest of her body had a death pallor. She had long since stopped breathing. I quickly unhooked her and laid her full length on the floor. Her pupils were dilated. There was no pulse in her neck. No heartbeat could be heard with my ear to the chest. I started external heart resuscitation while her roommate ran down the hall to get help from the nursing staff. Oxygen and breathing masks were substituted for mouth-to-mouth ventilation. The electrocardiogram showed straight line, standstill. No electric shock would have helped. Intravenous sodium bicarbonate and epinephrine were given directly in repeated doses, while other drugs were added to the intravenous bottle. Continuous drip infusion of medications were given to support the blood pressure and help correct the shock. She was then taken to the intensive care unit by the stretcher, where she remained in a coma for 4 days. Because of dilated pupil, it appeared that brain damage had occurred from inadequate circulation during the period of heart arrest. Surprisingly, though, after a few hours, her blood pressure started returning to normal. Her urine output increased as adequate circulation of blood was restored. It was several days before she was able to speak. She eventually regained all of her faculties and returned to work several months later. To this day, she believes she had been some sort of automobile accident that caused her neck to be sore for so long. She says, whereas she entered the hospital with severe depression, she has now recovered with no residual depression or suicidal tendency, apparently cured by the prolonged period when the brain had no blood supply. I guess that's one way of curing depression. If you want to hear the tape of my lecture, I have other means, lastly. About the second day after recovery, this is from her coma, I asked her if she remembered anything at all. She said, quote, "I remember you working on me. You took off your plaid brown coat and threw it on the floor, and then you loosened your tie. I also remember that your tie had white and brown stripes in it. The nurse who came to help you looked so worried. I tried to tell her I was all right. You told her to get an Ambu bag and also an Intracath to start an IV. Then the two men came in with a stretcher. I remember all of that." Unquote. Recall with me, she was in a deep coma that particular time and remained in a coma another 4 days. At the time I took off my brown plaid coat, only she and I were in the room, and she was clinically dead. This, of course, is only one of many stories. One story that I love to tell over, and I've probably told it in this class, this is, by the way, the 18th lecture of this series, is the story about a woman called June. She also was an extremely difficult situation. She was in the operating room. She claims that her consciousness left her body. It was hovering over her body. She saw the operation, and she got bored. If you see one operation, you've seen them all. And she decided to go next door across the hall into the waiting room, where she claims that she saw her brother-in-law, who happened to meet an old friend. And they were schmoozing. They were talking. And the friend asked the brother-in-law, "Hey, what are you doing here?" So the brother-in-law replied, "It looks like my sister-in-law June's about to kick the bucket. And I had to cut short my business trip because probably I'm going to be one of the pallbearers." She heard enough. June went back into the operating room. The operation was a success. In the recovery room, when the brother-in-law came to see June, June's first words were, "Next time you go on a business trip, you can keep on going. I'll be just fine." And it looked like he was going to have a near-death experience. So again, the S of search is soul. The E of search is eternity. It's interesting how when the Torah describes the death of Abraham, and we can look at it as under E, again, page 2. "And Avram gave up his spirit and died in a good old age, an old man full of years, and was gathered to his people." You see in the bold print. "And his sons, Isaac and Yishmael, buried him." So first he died, next he was gathered unto his people, and then he was buried. according to the Zohar, which is the classic book of Jewish mysticism, when a person dies, he is very often met by his deceased relatives who come to escort him to his new place. There are many recollections and many studies about people who claim to have seen either deceased relatives or angels right before they died. The Talmud mentions a few cases. I'd like, though, now to quote from a work. This was a work done by two psychologists, two PhD psychologists, one Carlos Osis and the other Erlander Haraldsson, who did a cross-cultural study interviewing doctors and nurses, asking them, did they see something unusual when their patients died? And these are interviews of doctors and nurses, the title of the book is What They Saw at the Hour of Death. And I'd like to quote two of those studies. Here's an example of a pre-death vision that was reported by a nurse who was at the deathbed of a man in his 40s. Quote, he was unsedated, fully conscious, and at a low temperature. He was a rather religious person and believed in life after death. We expected him to die, and he probably did too, as he was asking us to pray for him. In the room where he was lying, there was a staircase leading to the second floor. Suddenly he exclaimed, "See, the angels are coming down the stairs. The glass has fallen and broken." All of us in the room looked towards the staircase, where a drinking glass had been placed on one of the steps. As we looked, we saw the glass break into 1,000 pieces without any apparent cause. It did not fall, it simply exploded. The angels, of course, we did not see. A happy and peaceful expression came over the patient's face, and the next moment he expired. Even after his death, the serene, peaceful expression remained on his face. I'll quote another interview. This is from a doctor who recalls the experience of a seriously ill patient. The condition of the man suffering from a heart attack had been serious for the last few days. Suddenly he gained consciousness. He looked better and cheerful. He talked nicely to his relatives and requested them to go home. He also said, "I shall go to my home. Angels have come to take me away." He looked relieved and cheerful. According to Dr. Michael Sabon, in the book that we quoted before, Recollections of Death, 48% of those that claim to have this out-of-body experience saw others in the spiritual realm. Many of them were deceased friends or relatives. I'd like, before we go on, to quote from a rather unusual book. We've quoted from this in previous lectures. This is by Dr. Brian Weiss. The name of the book is Many Lives, Many Masters. At the time that Dr. Weiss wrote this book, he was the head of the Department of Psychiatry in Mount Sinai Hospital in Miami. He was trying to treat a patient who was not responsive to conventional therapy. She had many phobias, which he wasn't able to cure. He put her under hypnosis, and he began to ask her, "Tell me what was the cause of your phobia." And she started going back into previous lifetimes. And this is the name of the book, Many Lives. She also claimed that there were spiritual masters. There were souls, advanced souls, that helped her along, and helped everyone along. He was, of course, by his training, he was very skeptical. Until the following situation. She was under hypnotic trance, and she said that the spirits of Dr. Weiss's father and deceased father and deceased son had come. Quote, "Your father is here and your son, who is a small child. Your father says you will know him because his name is Avram," which is his Hebrew name. She was a Catholic girl. She did not know Dr. Weiss intimately. Most certainly, very few people except the people that saw him have an aliyah in shul and has come to the Torah in shul knew that his father's Hebrew name was Avram. I think the English name was Alvin. And your daughter is named after him. He gave a name to his daughter Amy as, to honor the remembrance of his father. Also, his death was due to his heart. Your son's heart was also important, for it was backward like a chicken's. He made a great sacrifice for you out of his love. His soul is very advanced. His death satisfied his parents' debts. In other words, the parents were destined to go through that suffering to pay some sort of sin that they had. Also, he wanted to show you that medicine could only go so far, that its scope is very limited. As a result of the death of his child, he decided to change his career. Instead of being an internist, he decided to go into psychiatry. In this book, in describing the many lives, one of the most fascinating things is under hypnosis, she describes her death and describes it exactly like those who describe their near-death experiences. And now I'll quote from this. He gives her name to be Catherine in this book. Quote, "I feel free, free." She's reliving death under hypnosis. Catherine gently whispered, "I'm just floating in darkness, just floating. There's a light around and spirits, other people." And again, another section of the book, and again, another session. She's being hypnotized. Again, she's reliving another death of another life. "I have left my body." Her voice was louder and husky. "I see a wonderful light. There are people coming to me. They're coming to help me. Wonderful people. They are not afraid. I feel very light." And of course, this fits in the idea that when Avram died, he went to the Yosef El Amov, he was gathered to his people. One fascinating story, which is brought, which is clearly, we see that the belief in life after death is an incident which is described in the book of Samuel, of Shmuel. King Saul, Shaul HaMelech, is about to die. The Philistines have amassed troops. He is very frightened. He goes to the town of Ein Dor, and sees a witch, a medium. He wants to contact the deceased spirit of the prophet Samuel. And she was able to conjure up the spirit of Shmuel HaNavi, of Samuel. And Samuel said to Saul, "Why have you disturbed me?" It's the bottom of page 2. And Saul answered, "I'm sorely distressed." There's a whole conversation between the deceased Shmuel, you can read yourself, and Shaul HaMelech and King Saul. Not only, again, the E of eternity is not only do we have a soul, but at death, the soul goes to a spiritual place. Which leads us to A, accountability. What are we doing here? If we're eventually going to land up there, what are we doing here? And again, the teachings of every single religion, and of course Judaism, is that here, we are here to change our lives. We have free will here. We can make a difference here. We come to this world as babies, experience all kinds of different experiences, and we make all kinds of choices. We change ourselves over. And ultimately, we'll have to come back, and there will be an accounting. What have we done with all the opportunities that were given to us? And this is accountability. You could look at again, in your sheets that we quote from the book of Ecclesiastes, and we quote Rashi's explanation. Who is the person that is aware that the soul of a man goes up? And Rashi explains in his commentary, it goes up and stands in judgment. I'd like again to quote for you from Dr. Moody, another book that he wrote. It's called Reflections on Life After Life. "I was first out of my body, above the building, and I could see my body lying there. Then I became aware of the light, just light, being all around me. Then it seemed there was a display all around me, and everything in my life just went by for review, you might say. I was really very, very ashamed of a lot of the things that I experienced, because it seemed that I had a different knowledge. The light was showing me what was wrong, what I did wrong, and it was very real. It seemed like this flashback or memory, whatever it was directed primarily at ascertaining the extent of my life. It was like there was a judgment being made, and then all of a sudden the light became dimmer, and there was a conversation, not in words, but in thoughts. When I would see something, when I would experience a past event, it was like I was seeing it through eyes, this is with, I guess you would say, omnipotent knowledge guiding me and helping me to see. That's the part that has struck me, because it showed me not only what I had done, but even what I had done had affected other people. And it wasn't like I was looking at a movie projector, because I could feel these things. There was feeling. And particularly since I was with this knowledge, I found out that not even your thoughts are lost. Every thought was there. Again, which is, if you'll notice the last quote here in accountability, in terms of the judgment. Really, we are judged totally for everything that we do. This situation could be regarded as being the most unpleasant indeed, and it was no wonder that quite frequently, this is Dr. Moody is speaking, quite frequently people may come back from this feeling that they need to make a change in their lives. Considering the following passages taken from interviews from two men. The first quote, "I didn't tell anybody about my experience, but when I got back, I had this overwhelming, burning, consuming desire to do something for other people. I was so ashamed of all the things that I had done or hadn't done in my life. I felt like I had to do it, that it couldn't wait." And the next quote, "When I got back from this, I had decided I better change. I was very repentant. I hadn't been satisfied with the life I had led up to then, so I wanted to start doing better." Again, S is soul, E is eternity, A is accountability, which brings us to R, reincarnation. Even though this is probably one of the best kept secrets amongst Jews, one of the most basic tenets of the Kabbalah, of the mystical teachings of Judaism, is that there is reincarnation. And I quote to you on page 4, in the first paragraph, paragraph A, from the Zohar, in one of the citations that deals with reincarnation. And it explains on that basis the importance of a speedy burial. As by Jewish law, someone who dies should be buried as soon as possible. And it explains from a mystical viewpoint that the soul cannot be reprocessed and be reincarnated unless the first body is taken care of. I'd like to quote from you, from one of the major researchers into reincarnation phenomena. This is Dr. Ian Stevenson. He wrote a book, and I highly recommend reading these books. One is 20 Cases Suggestive Reincarnation. The other book is Xenoglossy, where people have remembrances of archaic languages that they never could have picked up in this lifetime. And yet they have memories of this. This, however, this quote is from another book from Dr. Stevenson. It's called When Reincarnation and Biology Intersect. And he describes a very interesting phenomenon of people who have birthmarks. And the birthmarks that they have are based, according to his research, on events that occurred prior to the death of that person in a previous lifetime. It's as if like a mark of Cain, a remembrance of what occurred. And let me quote to you two cases. I mean, it's fascinating. One, I'll quote now the first case. Nasruddin Shah was born in a village of Shah Jahanpur district of Uttar Pradesh, India, in April 1962. His family were Muslims. His father was a poor, landless laborer. Nasruddin was born with several birthmarks, of which the most prominent was a lens-shaped birthmark on his left chest. His family did not understand its significance until Nasruddin began to speak about a previous life. When he did speak, he said that he was a Thakur, that is, a member of the second highest ranking caste of Hindus, not Muslims, Hindus. Without saying so explicitly, he indicated that he came from a nearby village called Fargana, like Fargesan. Fargana. He said that he was called Hardev Baksh Singh and had been killed with a spear during a quarrel over cattle. These and other statements that Nasruddin made were correct for the life of a man called Hardev Baksh Singh, a Thakur landowner in Fargana. This Dr. Stevenson did the research on this. During a quarrel over cattle, which had become violent, one of his adversaries drove a spear through his left upper chest. Remember, he had a birthmark in his left chest. And died almost immediately. The post-mortem report confirmed the close correspondence and location between Nasruddin's birthmark when he was born and the fatal spear wound in Hardev Baksh Singh. The most remarkable feature of this case, apart from the principal birthmark, was Nasruddin's quote-unquote Thakur behavior. Although born a Muslim, he considered himself a Hindu. Moreover, he regarded himself as one of a particular distinction. For example, because the Thakurs were the second highest caste in India, he refused to engage in activities such as collecting cow dung for fuel that most village boys in India would undertake without question. Because it's apostamish, you know, he's a Thakur, because it's unbecoming. Nasruddin, says, also resisted the Islamic religion. He would not say Islamic prayers or go to the mosque. Nasruddin's parents knew that reincarnation is not part of the teaching of their religion, but Nasruddin's statements and behavior convinced them that he was the reincarnation of Hardev Baksh Singh. I'd like to say over another story. I think all in all, in his research, he interviewed some 2,500 people, Dr. Stevenson. Mang A. Kai, a subject of Burma, had a large birthmark on the side of his head. It was hairless, puckered, and scar-like. He said he remembered the life of a man, Maung Shwe, who had been captured, shot, and killed by communists at the time of the insurgency in Burma during the early 1950s. Maung Shwe's murderers threw his body into the flooded river, where it floated downstream until it bumped against a dock. From there, the owners of the dock pushed it back into the river. One of the owners became Maung I Kwai's mother. She must have become pregnant within a few weeks. Perhaps a few days of the arrival of Maung Shwe's body at her family's dock. In other words, the soul was hovering, and it entered this woman. As a child, Maung I Kwai, you have to excuse my Burmese, remembered being shot and then in a discarnate state following Maung Shwe's body as it floated down the river until it came to the dock owned by the family of his mother-to-be. This case illustrates what I call, quote-unquote, quote, geographical factor, which I find helpful in trying to understand why a child of one village has memories of a life in another, often remote village or town with which the child's family had no obvious connection. Maung Shwe's widow later married and then again became a widow. When Maung I Kwai grew up, he sought out Maung Shwe's widow and married her. In other words, I don't know if they use the same rav again, but they use the same rabbi, but he got remarried to the woman that he claimed was his own widow. The teachings of Judaism, as well as the teachings of others who believe in reincarnation, believe that the purpose that we are here, back again, is to perfect ourselves. We're given another chance. But if we're given another chance, how are we to know what we're here to perfect? I mean, what are we back here for? I mean, what have we done wrong? The Vilna Gaon, the great rabbi of Vilna who died some 200 years ago, explained the following very problematic passage of the Talmud based on the teachings of reincarnation. And this is on page 4, paragraph B. There was an argument for 2.5 years between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, the school of Shammai and the school of Hillel. Is it better for a person to have been born or not to have been born, to create it or not been created? The Vilna Gaon explains this, that really the question is not the original creation. According to the Vilna Gaon, if God created us, it must have been for our best interests. However, so the question is it better to finish all you need to do in one lifetime, or perhaps to come back and leave things unfinished in one lifetime and come back? You can both finish up the unfinished business and be able to do so much more good, basically, if you have an extended lifetime. It would probably be the analogy if you are on the roulette table, right? And you have a winning streak. Should you keep on going? This, according to the Vilna Gaon, was the argument between the school of Shammai and the school of Hillel. Finally, they came to an agreement that it would be best to stop while you're ahead. Best finish up everything in this lifetime. But if you didn't, and you want to know why you were coming back for another lifetime, you should investigate your deeds. Take a stock of your actions. Where are your weaknesses? Because you find, says, where your weaknesses are, in all probability, that's what you're here to correct in this lifetime. We have discussed now the near-death experience. We've discussed being judged. We've discussed reincarnation. I will briefly want to discuss two other means of what, because different people take different paths. Not everyone goes to heaven, and not everyone is reincarnated. C is for cursed. Some people just go nowhere. We discussed the story of reincarnation about the body that just hung around. There are many stories like this. Time doesn't allow. But there is a vast literature of the Dybbuk, of souls that are condemned to wander the earth and sometime find sanctuary in another living person. I have a story, but again, we have to cut. This class is limited, but in 25 words or less, there was this woman who lived in Lithuania who had an experience that they claimed a Dybbuk took her over. It was an unusual situation. They went to a mystic, to a makubal, and he was able to have that second spirit speak through this woman. The mouth was not talking. It was just a voice coming. The stomach was rising up and down. And just a voice that came from within the woman. And the person described another life, that he had come from Brest-Litovsk, from Brisk in Polish Lithuania. He had left Lithuania, went to South Africa, had fallen into bad company, and totally forsook the Torah and became a totally, just totally lost it. He died a violent death. It was some sort of an accident. And he was forced, he was condemned just to wander the face of the earth. And he described that he was hounded. We call these malachai chavola, these angels of destruction. That he was constantly hounded. He was a living hell on earth. Until he found sanctuary in this woman. He went through this process of exorcism. And it left, which is the common means in all these stories. And these were written, by the way, by great scholars. This is not just part of Bubba Mises. I mean, these were written by... No, and I'm just saying, these are not just old wild, we were told like in a dark night in front of a fireplace. You know, these are... These were sort of just like the researchers that we described in reincarnation near-death experiences. The soul of this tormented person left this girl and exited through her fingernail. The fingernail broke. The glass where the room was shattered, and that soul left. There are many, many stories like this. Again, just time does not allow. The second is H, which is hell. In a 1952 Gallup poll, while less than half of all Americans stated that they didn't believe that they did not believe in hell. In other words, there were those who were not sure, those who had a firm belief, but a minority firmly did not believe in hell. 85% of all Jews firmly denied the existence of hell. In a subsequent Gallup poll in 1965, the number of Americans was still less than half who definitely believe there is no hell. The percentage of Jews who denied in this poll that he took denied hell was 97%. Hell is a Jewish belief. I quote for you, you can see this is one of the many places it's mentioned. This is on page 5. The Christian view of hell is taken from the Jewish view. You have to realize that Jesus and all the apostles went to yeshiva, went to cheder. And much of the belief of the New Testament is really a modified form of Judaism. I have, and again, time does not allow, from a book that I quoted before from Dr. Maurice Rawlings, about someone who reported that he was in hell in his near-death experience. It was very frightening, so frightening that Dr. Rawlings changed his life because of that report. Different souls take different routes. But the important thing to realize in all these near-death experiences was the people did not actually die in the near-death experiences. They had near-death experiences. It was like they were given a tour of what's out there. Some of the tour was good and some of the tour is not good. The person that he had all these terrible memories of hell, and he kept on going in and out of death, also remembered positive experiences. And it reminds me of the story or joke that we've said before in this class about David Ben-Gurion. According to this story, 3 weeks before David Ben-Gurion died, he had a dream. And in his dream, he died. And his soul went up to the heavenly court, and there were three esteemed sages, and they told him that normally we're the ones who choose whether you go to heaven or go to hell. But since you were the first prime minister of Israel, you devoted your whole life to the Jewish people, we are making an exception in your case. You yourself will choose whether you want to go to heaven or hell. This man, a kluger yid, he was a very smart fellow, Ben-Gurion. He says, I've got to be shown what's heaven and what's hell. First they took him to heaven, and it was like a big yeshiva. And he said, I saw enough. Show me the other place. They took him to hell, and it was wonderful. It was lush, and there was laughter and music and wonderful smells and wonderful food. It was gewaltig, and he woke up. 3 weeks to the day, Ben-Gurion actually did die. And the scene that he had seen in his dream was played in actual life. His soul went up in front of this heavenly tribunal, and his three esteemed sages came and told him that because he was the first prime minister, he will be offered a choice that no one else has offered. You can choose whether you want to go to heaven or hell. This time, though, he did not have to be shown. He immediately said, I want to go to hell. And there he was taken. And it was hot. It was hot. And people were screaming and it was terrible. And he looks at his angel guide and he said, "Wait a minute, this is not the place they showed me." And the angel looked at him and said, "Ah, they probably showed you the place they show the tourists." But in truth, the people in the near-death experience did not really die. But they had a taste of the afterlife experience. But according to some of that experience was not that positive. Ultimately, the idea is, which is, again, basic to all religions, we will be rewarded for that which we've done positive, and an accounting will be made for the faults that we could have corrected. Which comes now to the next part of our acronym, which is LIFE. We went through search, and now is LIFE. What are you supposed to do? Of those who have the near-death experience, and who claim they went into this other world and saw this being of light, almost universally, they said the most important thing is love. What should you do when you come back? Love. Give. Here we have on the bottom of page 5, it says, Shimon HaTzadik, Shimon the Righteous, was amongst the survivors of the Great Assembly. He used to say, the world depends on 3 things, on Torah study, on service of God, and on loving kindness. Love and care is one of the most primary things of what this world is all about. And as we quote in page 6 from Avraham Rabbi Nosson, it says, the world was originally created only with kindness. The creation was an act of kindness. We are supposed to imitate God and show that kindness. And in fact, again, you could read the passage that after the temple was destroyed, we have another means of atonement, not just sacrifices. We're atoned by doing good things to other people. We want to know, it says, how do we prepare for the afterlife? The first thing is love. And again, we are going to be, by all accounts, both by Jewish and non-Jewish, and by scientific accounts, we are going to be judged. And we should start judging ourselves and saying, I probably have a tremendous potential. I could do so much. Am I living up to my potential? Because eventually we're all going to be asked that question. And first and foremost, we should ask ourselves, am I loving enough? Am I giving enough? We all have situations in the workplace. We have colleagues, we have employees, we have employers. They all have needs. Everyone needs to be loved. Are we fulfilling those needs? So the first is L is love. The love in the workplace, the love in our home, the love of our spouses and our parents and our children, or our colleagues and friends. The next I is inspiration. It's very important to pray. Because after all, and again, this is the teachings of all religions, and this is the teaching of Judaism. Ultimately, the end result is that we become close to God. Prayer is giving your life over to God. It's not just a wish list of gimme this and gimme that. It's really putting your life in God's hands. As we said, as we quote here in the bottom of page 6 in the bold print here, the prayer of the righteous is his desire. As we said, the world depends on 3 things. One of them is the service of God. Even without a temple, prayer fulfills this pillar. And it's important to always pray. Not just once a week when you go to shul on Shabbos or once a year. It's a constant thing. Because basically, prayer is an attitude. one of the most basic prayers, and I just like to take the liberty just to quickly say this over. One of the basic prayers is that when we use the bathroom, we're thankful that our body is healthy. And the prayer is called Asher Yotzar, you know, God who is formed. This is the man with wisdom has created all kinds of hollow areas. There's all kinds of orifices, and they all work. And if there's any obstruction or there's any rupture, we will not be able to survive. And it's a thanks that our body is functioning. It's in a certain sense a way of connecting to God countless times during the day. I just, again, because of time, I'm not going to read this whole article. This is taken from JAMA. This is the Journal of the American Medical Association. This is a part of the thing that's called A Piece of My Mind, where doctors write in. And there's a doctor, his name is Kenneth Prager, who describes this prayer and describes a patient, his name was Josh, who had a terrible accident. And despite all odds, they said initially he was be a quadriplegic. He was able to walk and function, and finally he was able to urinate because it was just he was just using the catheter. The urologists were very pessimistic about his chances for not requiring catheterization. They had not seen this occur after a spinal cord injury of this severity. The impossible happened. I was there the day Josh no longer required a urinary catheter. I thought of Abaye's Asher Yotzer. Abaye is the one in the Talmud who introduces this prayer, pointing out that I could not imagine a more meaningful scenario for its recitation. I suggested to Josh, who is also a yeshiva graduate, that he said the prayer. He agreed. As he recited the ancient bracha, tears welled in my eyes. Josh is my son. Praying is a means of coming close to God constantly. F is fulfillment. And this is, you should read this. This is the last paragraph from page 7. Before we are born, according to the Talmud, we all make an oath. And the oath is we will be righteous people. We promise that to God before we are born. Ultimately, when we live our life, we're fulfilling our promise. According to the Talmud, it says every Jew on Mount Sinai, and even the souls of Jews who were not born yet, made a promise to fulfill the Torah. We reiterate, every human being reiterates this promise before he is born to be a good person. Leading an upright life, and for a Jew, it's a life based on the guidelines of Torah, is not just something which is preferable. This is halt and vote. It's keeping your word. It's a promise we made to God 3,000 years ago at Sinai. It's a promise that we made to God before we were born. And finally, the E is education. Amongst those who had near-death experiences, one of the most significant things they had was they saw the importance of gaining knowledge. And let me just quote to this briefly. Several people have told me that during their encounters with quote-unquote death, they got brief glimpses of an entire separate realm of existence in which all knowledge, whether past, present, or future, seemed to coexist in a sort of timeless state. Alternately, this has been described as a moment of enlightenment in which the subject seemed to have complete knowledge. In trying to talk about this aspect of their experience, all have commented this experience was ultimately unexpressible. But yet, when they came back, they all felt the need to spend their life in continued study. According to the Talmud, study, gaining wisdom, is one of the primary things of life. We discussed love, this is loving kindness, chesed. We discussed avodah, service, which is prayer, which is giving yourself over to God. But the E is education. We owe it ourselves to expand our minds. We quote here on page 8, paragraph C, the study of Torah is equal to all of the other commandments. It's important to spend your life growing. In many lives of many masters, again, this Catherine under hypnosis, describing what the masters, these spirit masters, are telling her. She says it's all growth and learning. Continuous growth. Our body is just a vehicle for us while we're here. It is our soul and our spirit that last forever. And ultimately, and really this is really the teaching of Judaism, ultimately, you're not going to grow until you begin to open your mind and start reading and start thinking and start studying. I end off on page 8 with a very famous quote from the Talmud. This is an Ovos. Rabbi Yaakov said, "This world is a lobby before the world to come. Prepare yourself in the lobby so you may enter the banquet hall." Life is very important. Every moment is precious. The Talmud speaks of Yesh Koino Eloma B'Shoachas, a person that can acquire his whole spiritual world in one instant. Every instant is precious. We title this talk, How to Prepare for the Afterlife. Ultimately, this, how to prepare for the afterlife is A, the realization that there exists an afterlife. I quoted many sources. I don't want you to rely upon me. I want you to go out to the library and bookstore, get these books and read them. The evidence is very impressive, and it all supports the traditions of our fathers and forefathers. The second thing is, take life seriously. You know, you may not have realized that, but we're not in paradise yet. This is the training ground. This is the lobby. There's so much good we can do. There's so much change we can make in our life. But we have to have the resolve to make that change. And finally, and this is again one of the most famous quotes from the Talmud, Habo l'taher misayin oso. He who comes to purify himself will get help. You have to make the first step. The Medrash says, if you open up your heart and make an opening the size of the eye of a needle, I'll open it to the size of the opening of the temple, an immense opening. But you have to make that small first step. You make that first step, and a whole world will open up to you. Thank you. Are there any questions? The truth is, and I would like you to go and get those books. Those books speak of very common low lives, depressed lives, all kinds of lives. And it's really, the truth is that those who have these recollections recall very, very plain lives as well. There are three books that Dr. Ian Stevenson wrote. I mean, probably there are more, but three that I'm familiar with. About reincarnation. I mean, if you're wondering about reincarnation, one is 20 Cases Suggestive of Reincarnation. The other is Xenoglossy. Xeno means foreign, and glossy is tongues. And the other is When Reincarnation and Biology Intersect. Also, I suggest reading Many Lives, Many Masters by Brian Weiss. Also, the lives that this woman recalls under hypnosis are also not very glorified lives, very, very plain lives. Yeah, yes?
If you were drawn to a past life experience yourself, and if not, why have you learned from them?
Okay. The point was very. This is a very good question. The question was, if I personally have had these experiences or went through hypnosis, if I didn't, why not? First is, I have not gone through hypnosis, and I do not recall any past lives. I have a problem with what I ate for breakfast, let alone what I have in past lives. But second of all, I truly believe that God generally hid it from us for a purpose. He really wants us to concentrate on the here and now. Many of those people who are involved in the study of previous lives and want to prove the idea that there is an afterlife make that a religion in itself and feel that the knowledge they have of these past lives is enough to get them on the right track and it's enough to give them support. And it really takes the place of what, at least according to the Torah, is really the serious business of living. And that's living. And that's perfecting yourself. And that's challenging yourself. By the fact is that we do not have normally these recollections, I believe it's for a purpose. And I think, you know, Judaism is really a religion of the here and now. You are really involved in what am I going to do today? What am I going to do tomorrow? How am I going to daven? How am I going to take care of the needs of my family or the needs of the community? It's a very, this world, spiritually, but this world oriented. And really, that's really what we're here for. So I believe that it makes very interesting reading, and I think it's very important reading. But I think a person should take the reading and take it from there and spend the rest of his life doing good things. There are two elements in this question about why doesn't the Torah, does the Torah describe the afterlife? First of all, we brought in the beginning of eternity, in the search, we brought two quotes that it seems definitely that those who live the life of Torah and the writers of Tanakh believed in the afterlife. First is the idea of gathered unto the people that we brought by Abraham. The idea of Shmuel Hanovi, that Samuel the prophet, whose soul was brought back. We quoted from Ecclesiastes that the spirit, you know, goes up to God after death. But reward is not mentioned. This is really for several reasons. And the commentaries struggle with this. They don't know the answer. But they offer some fascinating insights. One is, and it's important to know, every single religion and every single cultural group believed in an afterlife. That isn't what the Torah is coming to teach. The Torah is coming to teach how to live this life. The Torah is really the guideline of how to live a better life. So the first thing is the Torah does not have to describe it because it's a given. Everyone believed this. The second is that actually, one's familiar with the Talmud, that the bulk of Jewish knowledge is really in the Torah Shebaal Peh, is in the oral tradition. The afterlife cannot be truly described in words on paper, especially on words that are studied by a child in Cheder at 6 years old, or at 10 years old, or 15 years old. And it was left, the teachings was really left to the Kabbalah, was really left to the mystic tradition. Because it could not clearly be described, and it left it basically to the basic belief. It's intimated in the Torah, and it was the belief of all cultures. Thirdly, as the Ramban, as Nachmanides points out, the idea that one leads a good life and one is spiritually rewarded is not a miracle. It should be natural. I mean, that's what life is all about. But that God should intervene in this life, and it should rain, or you should have prosperity, or there should be suffering in this life, and is really a chiddush, is really something new that the Torah taught us. Because in the other religions, it's based on fate. It's not what happens to us in this world is not necessarily based on our deeds. The fact that God intervenes in the course of history is really a chiddush, is something new that the Torah wants to teach us. So that's why the afterlife is self-understood. This is something new which other religions denied.
Yeah. Okay.
The idea of Mashiach is a very long, that's another lecture. And I'm sure I've gone way beyond my 50 minutes. But let me just say one thing. Ultimately, we deal with an afterlife and reincarnation and are given another chance. There'll be a time when the buzzer sounds, and it's like musical chairs. You never played musical chairs? That when the music stops, you got to find yourself a seat, and there are less seats. There's going to come a time when all of mankind will be judged. You won't be given any more chances. You can't keep on thinking. At least the Jewish view is, well, it's going to last forever. You know, I don't do so well this time, I'll make it up the next time. You know, when Mashiach comes, it's going to usher in an era where everything has already stopped. It's really the end of history. It's the beginning of utopia. It's the beginning of the reward. But the music has stopped. So in a certain sense, the Jews, and it's a long-standing belief, we want Mashiach, and we want this messianic era, but it is very scary. Because when Mashiach comes, it's all over. There's no more reincarnation, no more chances. No, that's it. You know, so in terms of, at least vis-a-vis this lecture, Mashiach is a whole thing in itself. But regarding this lecture, the idea is history will come to an end and there will be an ultimate judgment day for everyone.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.